Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. Good to have you all with us here on the Mark Steiner Show. I want to remind you this you're listening now to Sound Bites in the Mark Steiner Show. You're listening to it here on WEAFM, celebrating 88 days of summer. Details at WEAA.org. And you're also listening to us on Delmarva Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM around the Delmarva Peninsula. As we search for answers and questions around the future of our food system here in America, I remind you support for WEA is provided by AAA Mid-Atlantic. More information available at 866-452-7771. And this hour on Soundbites, we are going to cover a number of areas. One of those areas is chickens, the future of chicken farming. The differences between, over the years, we spent a lot of time talking with folks in the Purdue industry, people who work for the Purdue company, farmers who farm for Purdue. We've talked to farmers of all kinds across the shore and across Maryland. Just a few weeks ago, we talked to one of the Purdue farmers about his operation and what they were doing there. And this part of our program, we're going to be talking to three farmers who raise chickens in a different way for different reasons and talk about what that industry means. And it's a huge industry here in the state of Maryland. It's a huge industry around the country. We're talking about think about this one moment before we get into the heart of this discussion. Between in the chicken growing area of America, between where we live here in Maryland and Delaware, and all the way through the Southeast, the number of, and we call the broiler belt, the number of chickens outnumber people 400 to 1. 400 to 1. Well, let me introduce our guest and we'll jump into the conversation. In the studio, Steve Martinez raises chickens at Pluma Feliz Farms in Baltimore County. He's also a high school English teacher. And Carol Morrison joins us by phone. He raises chickens at Bird's Eye View Farm in Pocomoke City, raising egg-laying hens. We visited her before on a farm and did several specials with her. Carol, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good morning.
And Ted Wykoll is back with us. He is a third-generation farmer and owner of Green Branch Farm in Salisbury, Maryland. And we visited him and done a series of stories on his farm as well. Ted, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good morning.
And you all can join us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow at gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages or tweet us at Mark Steiner. We want to hear from you. 410-319-8888. And you can stream us live right now to WEA.org and call in 410-319-8888. Let me take a step back. Let me start with you, Carol Morrison, because it's been a while since you and I have spoken. But you have seen this chicken industry from your farm, where you and your husband, your husband's been farming for generations and generations, but you have been, you were a part of the large CAFO operations where you raised chickens, gave that up, and moved into your egg-laying operation, which has grown, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But talk about your kind of overview of that world, given where you all came from and where you are now.
Well, basically, we raised chickens for 23 years under contract for a major company. And, you know, following that, we became disenchanted with the whole system for several reasons and decided to move into a pasture-based system where the hens are free to go in and out as they please. Vastly reduced the number of chickens on the farm. We used to raise 54,400 chickens every 7 weeks, and now we have 1,200 laying hens that, as I said, go in and out of the poultry house as they please. They forage on pasture, eat bugs, worms, and, you know, act like chickens. So it's going from one end of the spectrum to the total opposite end of the spectrum in raising chickens is what we did here, and I'm very pleased with what we've done.
Yeah, your business has taken off, which we'll talk about in a minute. Because that's the business end of your operation has been really interesting to watch grow and how you've really grown exponentially. Now, you came to farming, Steve Martinez, from a completely different direction. You did not come from a farming background originally, but you decided to go into chickens.
No, I did not. My father was a cement mason. His grandfather was a cement mason, but my great grandfather was a cotton and a cotton farmer out in the Yuma Valley between Arizona and California. So I guess maybe way, way back there there is some.
It's in your roots someplace.
Yeah, somewhere down in the tributaries. But no, I didn't come through there through that sort of background, farming background. I came through it really through discussions and through my own thinking on how to rejuvenate spaces and not have chickens be a polluting force, or rather a rejuvenating force for the landscape. And also just to produce a chicken that I couldn't find around here for the first 3 years that I was in Baltimore, which is a pasture-raised, non-GMO fed, no antibiotics or any other chemicals in the chicken feed, a chicken. So,
and you raise your chickens in a certain way.
I do. There's a great farmer up in Dover, Pennsylvania, that's been a big help, Homer Walden.
Homer well, yep.
He's a great guy. And through Denzel Mitchell from the Five Seeds Farm, we were able to hook up. And so I use his chicken tractors, which is kind of a takeoff on the Joe Salatin sort of mobile pen. So my chickens are sequestered away in little shelters that are about 10 by 10. And every single day they're moved to a fresh piece of pasture, which means they're off of their own manure. They're always getting fresh grass, and they're out in the sunshine, which is pretty exciting, which is in stark contrast to what Carol's birds, or rather the way that in which Carol's birds were raised when she was a contract grower, and most other contract growers on the Delmarva Peninsula.
And yours are for meat birds. You raise meat birds.
I do. I raise meat birds. I do. Yes.
And Ted Wycall, that's just to give us our listeners who are just tuning in for the first time a sense, your farm is a very diverse farm over at Green Branch, right?
Yeah, we're pretty diverse. I really consider myself to be a vegetable farmer that grows chickens on the side, but we do. It's 95% of my time is in the vegetable field, but we do grow about 4,000 pastured broilers a year, 200 to 250 turkeys for Thanksgiving, and then we do about 80 to 100 free range pigs, and we have about 50 head of beef cattle.
And your chickens indirectly. I mean, I've seen your operation. I've seen you raising the chickens from when they were very young to and watch them kind of trail after the cattle in the fields. Talk a bit about your process of raising chickens.
Well, yeah. So it sounds very similar to what was it Steve? Is that your name?
Steve Martin, yes, it is.
Yeah. So it sounds very similar. It's kind of a spinoff of the Joel Salatin method that Joel Salatin pioneered a number of years ago. But essentially, they come in, they stay in a brooder house, which is just a place to give them shelter for a couple of weeks while they're small and they don't really have enough insulation feathers. So they stay protected in there for a couple of weeks, and then when they're ready, they go out and pasture in a pen that is about 8 by 10. It gets moved every day. So they get fresh grass that's clean. They don't dwell on their manure too long, which pretty much eliminates the needs for antibiotics. So we don't feed antibiotics, it makes a really good chicken. It's the chicken gets to have a diet that's very similar to what a wild chicken or a wild bird would enjoy, I think that makes a better quality product. So it also helps with the pastures and the fertilization, nutrient, cycling. So we do get extremely lush regrowth, and that's awesome for the cows. It's nice. It's part of a little system, a little nutrient loop that we try to facilitate, so that basically, all those nutrients that come into the farm are used in a cycle that builds on itself and helps with profitability. It helps with overall environmental health. It helps create a higher quality product, in my opinion.
So you do it for meat and eggs, or just meat on your farm?
Yeah, we just focus on meat birds. The egg layers is a whole other thing that we've kind of dabbled in, but we don't do that anymore.
So let me talk about the difference here. I mean, there clearly is a difference between growing chickens raising chickens the way the three of you raise chickens and the way most chickens in America are raised. Because we're talking about when you look at the numbers of chickens raised in the United States of America, they are the numbers, I'm just trying to find the exact number of chickens raised in America. It's here we go. This was 5 years ago. 8.9 billion chickens were raised and sold for food. That doesn't count the egg-laying chickens. It's a jump of more than 1,400% from 1950. So we came from an America where there was no chickens to a chicken in every pot, which was a campaign slogan even, to make sure people had meat on the table. So, go ahead, Steve.
I'm sure Carol could speak to this probably most directly, having been a contract grower, but if you wouldn't mind, chicken used to be really expensive, and it used to take a long time. And that's the chicken in the pot right there. I mean, one would have to raise up a set of egg layers and the cockerels that came out from the eggs that you hatched. You'd raise that for 20 weeks, and then that would be your chicken in the pot, and you wouldn't have many of those. Now, I think the statistics are we eat over, and I'm sure I'm going to get this wrong, but I believe it's over 80 pounds of chicken a year.
And that's correct.
It's gone up every year. So it definitely, I guess there's a chicken in every pot, and it sounds like in every hand. And
actually, there's not enough pots now for the chickens. So we're going to have to make some more pots.
So elaborate on that, Carol. What does that mean to you, in all seriousness?
Pardon me. Well, it's gotten to that point. I mean, we're overproducing.
Right.
For what people are consuming, and as you know, chicken used to be a special Sunday dinner, and now it's an everyday thing. It's fast food. You know, a lot of people don't cook anymore, so you don't have a need for the stewing hens or you know the meat birds. They're probably the least amount sold when chicken is sold. Most everything is now going to cut-ups and what they call further processed, you know, your chicken patties, your chicken nuggets, whatever. So chicken has become a real diverse thing, and it's quick and easy for a lot of people. However, it's my belief that what they call the old way, like our grandparents used to do, you know, we're going back in time with the new pasture raised, you know, it's growing by leaps and bounds all over the country. And in my opinion, it's a better bird.
I did a taste test with my kids once. When you talk about a better bird, I remember I did a taste test with my kids about 10 years ago or so, where I cooked dinner and I put three kinds of chicken out for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And one was that I bought from pasture raised chicken. Completely, and then there was a couple of the kind of birds I raised. I mean, I served, and the kids picked the pasture-raised chicken as the chicken that tasted good.
That was good taste.
Blindfold test. But the question I have is, though, what you were just saying, Carol. Let's kind of speculate on this for a minute. I mean, what would that mean? I mean, if could.
In what way?
In the sense that you're talking about that you know your frustration, and there are other farmers you've talked about who their frustration led them to kind of leave the CAFO world and to go to a different world. Most farmers, for lots of financial reasons and others, are not leaving that world. They're stuck in there with debts. They're stuck in there because this is the way they're making some money, and they don't want to leave it. But if the model transformed, when you said they taste better, then your life is better. But if that model transformed, what would it mean, do you think?
The CAFO model to a pasture.
I mean, how could you really transform it?
You couldn't. It would be impossible to do that with the amount of chickens that they're raising. You know, there just simply is not enough land available. And, I mean, I don't want to go much higher than the amount of hens that I have.
And how many did you say you had?
Okay, we are up to 1,200 now. We started with five, and I wouldn't go over 2,000 hens because, for the simple fact, we rotate them on the pasture so that we're not saturated with manure. The hens aren't picking up diseases or whatever from continual, you know, time spent in the same pasture on manure. If you're going to raise 50,000 chickens outside, number one, you wouldn't even be able to see what is going on with the flock of chickens.
Right.
I mean, if you had an injured bird, there'd be no way to manage the flock. Secondly, you would need a lot of land to pasture raise 50,000 chickens, and that simply is not available. Most of the land here on the peninsula is, you know, planted in corn and soybeans, which in turn goes back to the poultry companies for poultry feed for the chickens. So they would have to make a choice as to, you know, what they're going to use the land for. That would be a big issue. It would be simply impossible to do, in my opinion. I just can't imagine even trying to do it.
So, this is a very critical part of the discussion I just want to have with you all about where this leads. And Ted Weichel, I want you to jump in here because we've had these discussions similarly in the past, and it would almost be impossible. I mean, chickens has gone from being the third most popular beef to the most popular meat in America, meat I should say, 84 pounds of chicken a year at least that people eat in the United States, and some people say it's gone higher than that at the moment. In terms of your life and the life of agriculture, what does that mean for you, your analysis?
Well,
of that?
I mean, it's a different way of doing things. It's kind of a historical story that goes back a long ways to why we're doing the confinement chicken operations, but it is a great way to make a cheap chicken. That's why, you know, that's why it is the most popular meat now, is because it's very affordable and therefore accessible to people, so a large amount of the population can afford to eat it. Before, I think people ate much more of a diet based on herbivores. So that would be like, you know, sheep, cows, and possibly even goats. You know, a chicken is an omnivore, just like a pig is an omnivore, whereas herbivores would be your cows, your sheep, and goats. And so it used to be, different. It used to be more expensive to raise the chicken, but now that it's not, due to the industrialization, they basically take ecology out of the equation. And when you do that, it makes for a cheaper meat, but at the same time, it causes environmental problems just because there's such a large concentration. There's really an overpopulation of chickens. They produce so much manure now that it causes problems on the side. I don't know. I'm not the one to answer whether or not we could go entirely to a pasture-based model of raising chickens. That's a really difficult question. I mean, I kind of think that we could. I don't know if we would want to. But just a, you know, completely theoretical question as to, is it possible? Yeah, I think it's possible. We just need a lot more farmers. We need a different way of doing agriculture. But do we want to do that? I think it would go back to, you know, chicken would be a lot more expensive, and probably would not end up being as widely consumed as it is today.
That's a really interesting thought. Steve, do you want to jump in on your thoughts on this as well?
I mean, if we went to a pasture-based system, I mean, the chicken couldn't be the cornerstone. I mean, as Ted said, it would have to be an herbivore. I mean, that's partially the reason why people historically relied on herbivores as the centerpiece of their protein, that or fish if they were close to the ocean. And then these omnivores, sort of like pigs and chickens, would be on the periphery because they do require inputs. A cow, a goat, sheep are basically converting solar energy through their rumen directly into protein, which is something that a chicken can't do. I mean, the tastiest grass in the entire field, maybe a chicken will only be able to, even on the tastiest grass in the field, a chicken will only really be able to get maybe 10 to 15% of their diet off of that grass. The rest is going to have to come from supplements. So if we were going to turn towards a pasture-based system, which, you know, if oil spikes really, really high, or if people start leaving the industrial food system in droves, I don't think that chicken would end up being the cornerstone. It would probably have to be some sort of herbivore. And just one second, Carol said something. She said that maybe we're stepping back to the way our grandparents and may have raised chicken. And I think it's true in a certain sense, but I'm sure that my great-grandfather would have given his eye teeth for my Polynet electrified fence that's, you know, 48 feet tall, solar powered, you know. Yeah, it's amazing, you know. And, you know, I can move it, you know, a mile and not strain. I mean, it weighs the whole kit and caboodle weighs 36 pounds. I mean,
yeah, even I can handle it.
Right. And that, I mean, that's totally amazing. I mean, I feel like oftentimes people maybe make that like Portlandia joke that like, oh, we're stepping back to the 1890s. You know, your chicken has a name and, you know. You know, did he do well in elementary school? However, you know, did he have any friends? But it's not the 1890s.
No.
You know, thankfully we have, you know, miniaturization of silicon chips, and we can utilize the good parts of the industrial system and leave hopefully the rest of it behind. You know, leave
manure.
You have
a point there.
Yeah.
I mean, we were left with two 40 by 500 foot buildings with no use.
Right.
And we were able to use some of the existing equipment and one of the buildings, you know, for the chickens when they're inside. So we were able to use some of the new technology as well as, you know, some of the old. So I think we've come a long way in what we're able to do with raising the chickens in, you know, on pasture or whatever.
Right.
And I foresee, you know, there on this peninsula, there are, I don't know how many empty chicken houses. We're talking huge buildings.
Yeah.
And they're single-purpose buildings. There's nothing else you can do with them. So you either tear them down, you sell the farm, or you try to find an alternative. You know, doing what we did, I'm not saying we did it the perfect way. It, you know, it's all a kind of flying by the seat of your pants in transitioning. But I think there's opportunity there so that we can recycle some of these old buildings that are just, you know, sitting.
Well, and the buildings you have, Carol, I mean, I remember visiting them, and that's where your chickens go in the evening, and that's where they lay their eggs.
Correct. Right. And then all we did was cut holes in the sides of the buildings, you know, so that they're open all the time, and the chickens just come in and out as they please. You know, and we were able, like I said, to use some of the existing equipment, like automatic feeders, automatic drinkers, which is a time saver for me because I don't have to go around and fill up feed pans. So it's kind of using some of the new technology and, like I said, some of the old.
So we got to take a short break here. When we come back, we're going to come back. I'm going to kind of leap into the question and to jump into Ted Wyckoff first about what the future brings. And one of the things Ted said, he said that the kind of new kind of farming we have, the industrial farming, has taken ecology out of the equation, is what Ted said. So what would it mean to put that back in the equation? And what's the future of your farms and farms like you for you and the rest of us? We'll hit that as soon as we come back. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites. Reminding you, the Mark Steiner Show is sponsored in part by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Mortgage late? Don't wait. If you're struggling with your mortgage, the state of Maryland is offering housing counseling and legal assistance. Maryland's HOPE program can even help you understand the state's mediation law and the Attorney General's national foreclosure settlement. Don't wait. Get help today. More information at mdhope.org or at 877-462-7555. You're listening here to the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites both on Delmarva Public Radio, WSTL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM on the peninsula, and here in Baltimore, Maryland on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We are joined here right now by Steve Martinez, who raises chickens at Pluma Feliz Farms in Baltimore County. Carol Morrison raises chickens at her farm, Bird's Eye View Farm in Pocomoke City, on Delmarva, and Ted Wyckoff just near Salisbury, Maryland, on Green Branch Farm. 410-319-8888 is the number here. So, Ted, let me jump back to what you were saying earlier. When you said that the industrialization of farming kind of took the ecology out of the equation, as chicken farmers, I know you're more than a chicken farmer, but our other two guests are chicken farmers, and you're a chicken farmer to an extent with your 4,000 to 5,000 chickens a year. What changes that? Can it change? In terms of, you know, we're talking chickens here. I mean, it would change the nature of the cost of chickens, how we buy chickens, what we expect out of a chicken, and how you farm them. So what's your scenario about what the future could be, given the world you've chosen to work in?
All right. Well, basically, my farm's marketing focus is pretty much the local or, you know, the regional area. I don't export my products beyond, say, 60 miles from the farm. And since I sell to a local population, it makes a lot of sense for us to be diverse because, you know, it's really hard to sell. You know, if I only grew one thing, if I only grew chickens, I could overproduce the amount of chickens that the local population would actually want. And so that means that if I grow something else, then I might have a chicken and a tomato to sell to them. If I grow three things, I'll have three things to sell to them. So basically, by being diverse, it allows me to be kind of like a one-stop shop and service the local population more efficiently. The thing that leads to like a really good local market for products such as mine and the other farmers on the show is that people need to be educated as to how their food is grown, because it's a lot different, I think, than most people would imagine it to be. So the more people know and understand about farming and food production, I think it will build in more demand for a more ecologically friendly, small-scale, diverse type of farming. Now, that's not to say that we don't need export farms, because obviously they are absolutely necessary. You know, I think it's a lot easier for us to maintain kind of like a balance as long as people can understand what's going on. Other parts of the equation, I think, that would bring us back to a more maybe eco-friendly type of farming would be you know, kind of getting away from petrochemical inputs and relying more on natural fertility cycles, which would require, once again, diversification. So, you know, we don't really need to have manure anymore to grow corn for the chickens because, you know, hey, we can just bring in, you know, whatever, you know, nitrogen or potassium, phosphorus sources that we need from outside of the area. So we don't really need to rely upon animals to provide fertility anymore. And then also another point that I like to touch on is that, you know, we need, in my opinion, I would like to not have my tax dollars go to supporting, you know, basically farmers that I compete with for land resources around me. You know, basically corn subsidies is what I'm getting at. You know, the more, for every dollar that goes into, you know, subsidizing corn production, you know, that encourages that many more people to grow that type of a crop. So, and it also makes them more able to compete with farmers like myself for, you know, necessities such as land to expand production. So, you know, ecology, I think, is going to win in the long run. I think it's a matter of time, but it's at this point in time, I can see how it would make a lot of sense for somebody to adopt, you know, the conventional petrochemical type of farming and take ecology out of the equation.
Steve and then Carol. Steve, would you look at your – I'm saying Steve because he's sitting across from me. I can watch his head nodding and doing different things.
I have a slight advantage over you two in that respect only, I'm sure. Let's see. I mean, it is the truth. I mean, at least in Baltimore County and Carroll County, and to compete against the commodity corn, the corn farmers is, I mean, I don't think anybody can do it, really. I mean, they're pretty ensconced there. I feel like I just wanted to take one issue with what you said. I agree with almost everything else that you said, except for maybe the export farmers are definitely needed. don't know. For me, it's pretty sad to watch like the dead zone in the Upper Chesapeake Bay grow larger every year. And I've only been here for a few years. I was actually born in California, but you know that's a whole different set of ecological problems there. But here, watching the dead zone get larger and blue crab prices go higher, and friends of mine that were brothers of watermen talk about not getting as many rockfish as usual, and you know whole oyster populations dying. To me, it seems like it's a pretty sad thing to destroy our wonderful ecosystem in the Chesapeake in order to export cheap chicken that will become chicken nuggets for somebody in the Midwest or in New York City or somewhere else. Like trading that sort of bland commodity for a local rich flavor. I mean, where else can you get Chesapeake?
I totally agree. Yeah, that's not what I was. Point I was trying to make.
Okay, good.
That's all right.
I just wanted to bring that up anyways. So I just, thank you for clarifying that.
Carol?
I really think, as Ted said, you know, more and more people are becoming aware. It's a very slow process in education. You know, we've been kind of fit into a system, and it's take it or leave it, and there really isn't much choice. Now there is choice. And as people become more and more aware of how their food's produced, it's going to be a personal choice as far as what consumers do. Add in the problems with the Chesapeake Bay, and, you know, most people don't want to destroy the Chesapeake Bay as what we're doing right now. We need to find answers and to correct the problem, or we're not going to have it. I really think, in my experience from what I have seen, I see more and more consumers choosing local food production. And, you know, there's several reasons to do that. Not only are you, you know, in my opinion, getting a really good food that's raised on a local farm and you know how it's being raised, you're also supporting your local economy. So the dollars are staying in the community. They're not being, you know, exported halfway across the country or all the way across the country or the world for that matter, because, you know, chicken has gone global now. So I think it's a matter of choice, and as we educate people more, their education is the number one thing that needs to be done. And, you know, more and more consumers need to be brought into the discussion as to how they'd like to see their food rate. You know, as they become educated, what do they want? And I think that can be a successful thing. It becomes a community food thing. You know, I'm not just talking, you know, each individual town doing it, but if you take, let's say, a region and people decide how they want their food produced. I've seen examples of where consumers and farmers get together and consumers say, you know, well, we'd like to have this, this, and this. And then the farmers say, okay, well, we can do that. And this is how they decide what their, you know, food choice is going to be. So if we bring the consumers into the conversation and let them say what they want, I really see a future in all of it. And in doing so, we're going to take care of the environmental problems and, you know, the antibiotic-resistant bacteria and all the other things associated with the industrial farming. You know, I, for one, don't want a bunch of junk in my food. And I think there are a lot of people out there that would agree with me.
And I think that is, I mean, we're going to continue kind of wrestling with the future of chickens and farming and where we're going to go. And I think these is just the tip of the iceberg of the discussion. And I
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I always appreciate all of you being able to come to the show. And Carol Morrison and Ted Wyckoff, always available to kind of talk with our guests and enter these debates and discussions like we had today and Steve Martinez for the first time. I'll leave this thought. We've talked about the 8.9 billion chickens raises food in America. That was 2007, from what I could find. As I said, jump up more than 1,400% since 1950, but the number of individual farms raising chickens for food plummeted by 98% in the last 50 years.
Ooh.
So that, to me, was a very interesting juxtaposition of...
Well, there's one new one this year.
Yeah, your farm.
My farm. There you go. One new one this year. And 2006 for you, Ted? That was
yep.
when you started? So there we go. The two in the last 7 years.
Well, I guess mine can be considered a new farm, too.
Right. Yours as well, Carol. So there
I'm
we go.
I'm only 2 years old.
We're bucking the odds.
Yeah.
Well, I've had chicken from at least two of these. I've had Ted's chicken. Amazing chicken. I haven't had yours yet, but I'm about to do that, Steve. And Carol Morrison's eggs are just some of the best eggs I've ever had. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that on public radio or not, but I just did.
Thanks for the sales pitch. No, actually, I am having a serious problem of meeting demand.
That's a great problem to have, right?
Yes, it is, but it's a good problem, you know, monetarily, but it's also a thing of, wow, I never expected it. So I think it speaks volumes.
We have about a minute and a half left in the segment, so we've got to go to our next guest. But did you all want to have a closing thought, starting with Steve and Ted?
If I could just maybe plug the farm and where I sell my chickens, I'd appreciate it. My chickens are available at the Union Graze event, which is behind Artifact Coffee in Baltimore
Here
City.
In Baltimore, right.
That's on Fridays from 4:30 until 8 o'clock, and we're going to go until, I believe, November 1st as well. We're getting turkeys for the first time in Thanksgiving. Thank you so much.
And we'll be connecting to Paloma Feliz Farms and Steve's work, Ted, and we'll be connecting to your farm as well, Green Branch. Closing thought, Ted Wycall.
Yeah, I just, I really appreciate all the people that are listening to the show and thinking about where their food comes from. And it's just great to have, you know, been in this business for 7 years and just seen the excitement every year grow. Everybody just needs to be reminded that they vote with their dollars. If they don't want to, if they do want to know where their food comes from and know that it's raised environmentally friendly and as healthy as possible, then, you know, get out to your local farmers market, join your local CSAs, support your local farmers. You got to vote with your dollars.
And Carol Morrison, you, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
So Carol Morrison raises chickens at Bird's Eye View Farm, Pocomoke, Cesar Ted Wycall, Green Branch Farm, Salisbury, Steve Martinez, Pluma Feliz Farms here in Baltimore County. Thank you all three so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And we're going to transition here a little bit. We're talking about chickens. There are 523 million chickens produced every year in Delmarva, and they generate roughly 42 million cubic feet of chicken poop, waste, however you want to put it. And we're going to talk about what to do with that waste. Some people want to make it our next energy source. Stay with us. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back here to the Mark Steiner Show on Soundbites. Welcome back to our program here on Soundbites here on the Mark Steiner Show, our weekly look at the agricultural system in Maryland and our food system in the future. We are going to switch gears, as I said, talking about what we face from the other end of the chicken and what happens here. Michelle Merkel joins us, co-director of Food and Water Watch Justice Project for Food and Water Watch, and Tom Horton, professor of practice in environmental studies at Salisbury University, former Sun Environmental reporter for over 30 years, 35 years. Michelle and Tom, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Good to be here.
Hi, Mark. Happy to be here.
Good to have you both with us. So it's, as I said, we create a lot of chicken manure in this country and in this area. There was a meeting that was held. I know, Tom, you went to the other day that we only heard about the last minute, so we couldn't go. But it was kind of a Doug Gansler campaign event. But it was to talk about this moving chicken manure into a new energy source. And the one company that was actually going to build that, which we'll talk about in a moment, was not there. But, Tom, talk about what happened there and what this is, and we'll turn to Michelle.
Well, the Attorney General, who, of course, is running for governor, is looking, as many of us are, for alternatives to the current system of spreading so much of that chicken manure produced on Delmarva on the land. It's pretty clear that we just cannot, if we care about water quality, continue to spread that much chicken manure every year. So what do we do with it? You know, you can't just stick the farmers with it, make them pile it up. So everybody's looking for alternatives. And, you know, the meeting was interesting, Mark, because there were a number of people there from companies who are working to turn it into energy on the farm that the farmer would use, also other technologies that would turn it into diesel fuel, which could be sold or used on the farm. I thought one of the most interesting viewpoints was a guy who, unfortunately, his company is not working on Delmarva, but they're working around the country. He argued that in the medium term to short term, natural gas is just going to kill all other energy sources. It's going to be so abundant and so cheap, like the fracking or not, we're going to have it. He thought that probably long term, the best thing to do with poultry litter was to turn it into higher value products. And he mentioned several chemicals that were high priced and in demand, rather than try to go head-to-head with things like natural gas. You know, I don't think that's a short-term solution, but it opened my eyes to there are maybe alternative uses beyond just burning it. Then, of course, the biggest imminent proposal, which is a 10 to 25 megawatt chicken litter burning power plant that could become a reality, will become a reality, I think, that was not even discussed because the people from Green Planet Power apparently could not make the meeting. So that's sort of, in a nutshell, what we went over.
Now, Michelle, I know you weren't at the meeting, but you have some kind of thoughts on what this Green Planet Power plant might be that they're talking about moving to Salisbury, Maryland, or opening in Salisbury.
Yeah. Well, first I should say generally Food and Water Watch thinks that, you know, building new power plants to burn poultry litter only provides another Band-Aid for a corporate agriculture system that is environmentally damaging and, you know, bad for farmers and communities. There is only one other poultry litter power plant in the country in Minnesota, and when we looked at the emissions from that power plant, there were emissions of toxic chemicals and greenhouse gas pollutants that exceeded Maryland's coal-fired power plants. So you're creating a new waste stream into the air that's going to be harmful to communities potentially. And you're also not taking care of the problem because you have these power plants don't actually combust any of the phosphorus that is harming our waterways in the bay. It ends up in the litter, as does other pollutants like heavy metals and things that could concentrate. And you still have to get rid of it. You have to still you have this waste product at the end of the day. So it's not actually solving any problems, but it's creating another one, and that's these harmful air emissions.
So what I remember we talked to this about this once before, just in preparation for kind of looking at what's going on in Salisbury and the potential for building this chicken manure to energy plant, that you had, or there were some stats we read about the plant in Minnesota and what it emitted.
Yeah, they admit, you know, pollutants from poultry waste incineration include carbon monoxide, sulfur dioxide, particulate matter, sulfuric acid, dioxin, arsenic. I mean, a lot of these often odorless and colorless pollutants have been known to cause respiratory disease, cardiovascular diseases, and cancer, among other illnesses. And like I said, we looked at some of these pollutants from Fibermin, which is the Minnesota power plant that burns poultry litter, and they had exceedances of carbon dioxide and nitrogen oxide and other pollutants, greenhouse gas pollutants and things, like I said, that exceeded, you know, what our power plants are putting out and our coal-fired power plants are putting out in Maryland.
So I wonder what kind of conversation that you think this idea has and what it should generate in Maryland. I know that the Salisbury event was just the beginning. There'll be a number of events and people discussing what's going to be built in Salisbury, Tom Horton, what's planned to be built.
Well, you know, I have to say I like the concept of this plant. Now, obviously, if it can't be built without harming human health or violating Maryland air quality standards, then I don't think it will be built, don't think it should be built. But, you know, the state has already basically entered into a deal with Green Planet Power, which is a California firm, to build at least a 10-megawatt power plant somewhere on Delmarva. So I think the state, you know, thinks it can be done environmentally acceptably. That matter of phosphorus, yeah, you end up when you burn the manure with a phosphorus-rich ash, but from what I can find out, that's not too much of a problem because it's so rich in phosphorus, you can bag it and sell it as a commercial fertilizer, which can be applied where it's needed and in the doses it's needed by plants, no more. That, of course, is the problem with chicken manure. You can't meter it out by the ounce of phosphorus and nitrogen. You got what you got in the manure, and it's often not a good mix. So, you know, I would like to see the plant at least get to the point where we can examine its environmental impacts. And, you know, it's interesting. Green Planet Power beat out Purdue and another partner. The partner was the group that built the plant Michelle talked about in Minnesota. And immediately after the bid was given to Green Planet Power, Purdue called them up and said, let's partner. So, you know, officially, I don't think there's any deal struck at all, but I think Purdue and Green Planet Power are, you know, have talked quite a bit about going in on this. So I would not reject this plant out of hand. I think it will have a lot of hurdles to meet, and it should have a lot of hurdles to meet. But, you know, how big are we talking? A 25-megawatt plant could take 240,000 tons of poultry litter a year. It might not take that much. It might mix it with wood chips and stuff. But it would take a very substantial part of all the chicken litter on Delmarva. And, you know, it's I do not think we're going to spread it responsibly on the land, because that would mean for a lot of farms on the mid to lower shore, they just couldn't spread it anymore. The state's coming out with some new and improved regulations on that, but they're far short, I think, of what we need. So I think we got to find alternatives.
So in looking for those alternatives, Michelle, I'd like you to kind of, because we have to close out in a couple of minutes here, but what should we be talking about from your perspective, and what do we need to be asking?
Well, the alternative isn't entrenching an unsustainable system of agricultural system further. You know, Food and Water Watch did a really interesting economic study, and it estimated that, you know, farm sales on the Eastern Shore in 2007 could have been about $137 million higher if the region cultivated the same proportion of land and vegetables and fruits that it used to do before the rise of these poultry integrators. And so that's, you know, those additional earnings would exceed, you know, $83 million that contract poultry growers are estimated to have received in 2007 and who continue to live at or below the poverty line. I mean, we need to transition our farmers into a more sustainable system, have a more diverse system of agriculture. It's not going to happen overnight. It's not about farmers waking up and switching from, you know, feed for chicken corn to sweet corn, but we can develop a stronger regional food system that's more diversified if we invest in infrastructure and the capacity to deliver fruits and vegetable crops to, you know, existing consumers within a short drive of the Eastern Shore. And we have plenty of markets. We have Baltimore, we have Philly, we have Washington, D.C. So instead of spending millions of dollars, and I think Governor O'Malley just in the 2014 budget allocated, you know, $3 million in capital funds for manure to energy projects, and there's millions of more dollars that go to farmers that entrench them in this industrial model every year, we need to be spending those dollars in a way that strengthens our agricultural community, allow farmers to make a profit, that in a way that does not pollute our environment. I mean, it's we need to invest in building a more sustainable agricultural system rather than, like I said, investing in these Band-Aids that really just entrench this model that's not good for anybody.
So this is just the beginning of this discussion, and we really wanted to kind of touch it because it was a very brief meeting that took place in Salisbury. We're all kind of exploring what this means and what it will mean for the future of Delmarva and all the issues around. We are going to be working with several groups in the Eastern Shore and in Delmarva at the university and some other places to convene some town meetings to really talk about this and what this means for the future of Delmarva and the future of farming in the area, period. And so this is just our first kind of look at this at the end between our two guests, and we'll come back to this in much deeper ways and invite audiences to come and participate in our town meetings. I want to thank Michelle Merkel, who's co-director of the Food and Water Watch Justice Project for Food and Water Watch, Tom Horton, professor of practice in environmental studies at Salisbury University and former Baltimore Sun Environmental reporter for over 35 years, for joining us in this segment of Soundbites here on the Mark Steiner Show. Tom and Michelle, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
And that's it for today's program. I want to remind you on our way out of here that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Public Radio Delmarva is Christopher Rank. Our interns are Daniel Dupree, Alexander Rudy, and Sinead Hawkins. Theme music by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear the show, podcast the show, and find out information about our guests, where they work, the work they're doing, please go to our website at steinershow.org. You can also listen and download our podcast on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and WSTL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Thanks for listening to The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites. Take care.